supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. In an article entitled Elliot's Sexual Healing, the New York Post reported last week that former New York Governor Spitzer was seeking treatment for sex addiction. This has not been confirmed by Spitzer himself. Sex addiction was first described by Dr. Patrick Carnes in his 1983 book, Out of the Shadows. That was something we covered here on Voices in the Family in the very early days in the mid-80s. But there's been no large-scale research studies dedicated to this disorder that we were able to find anyway. But over the last two decades, therapists have learned a great deal about who's at risk for sex addiction, what kind of treatment works. They've learned a good deal about the brain chemistry of sex addiction and how partners of sex addicts are affected. My guest today is psychotherapist Carol Tripodi. She's director of STAR, Sexual Addiction and Recovery, in Wynwood, Pennsylvania. She's the co-author of Mending a Shattered Heart, A Guide for Partners of Sex Addicts. Carol, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And later on, we're going to hear from John. He's a gentleman who's in recovery for sex addiction. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you feel or have felt that you might be a sex addict or technically sex or love addict or married to one or know someone, give us a call. That's 888-477-9499. Kara, the article in the Post, it's headline said, Elliot's sexual healing seemed to mock the disorder. And right under the headline, it referred to addiction in quotes, you know, addiction therapy in quotes, as though it's not really an addiction. I assume you get that a lot. Kind of disrespect.
Disrespect or a need to sort of say that this is really just an issue of sort of moral character, and he's a person who just got himself into trouble and couldn't control himself. And although there are a lot of truth to all of that, what we find is that somebody like Spitzer, if in fact he is seeking treatment for sexual addiction, seems to fit a lot of what we see with people that present with this type of problematic behavior. And as much as we want to belittle it, which is what I think people do, it is certainly a very big problem that needs more education and understanding, which I think has changed in the last 20 years.
Well, let's bring up the question that always comes up when people are injured in the wake of addiction, whether it's alcohol or sex addiction, and people are terribly injured here.
Yeah.
So where does morality and accountability fit in? We can't turn our backs on it.
No, you certainly can't. But in order for there to be accountability, we have to first identify that there is a problem and what exactly is the problem. And a lot of times people just get caught up in sort of the outrage of it. And the outrage is very real, especially those affected by the other person's behavior that's been doing this behavior.
Well, what about the argument, and I know many of our listeners are wondering this now, what about the argument, well, it's just a horny guy, it's just a hypersexed guy, why do we need all these labels and treatment? What's the difference?
Because the idea of it being sort of a horny guy concept is something that, yes, there are, like anything, sex and behavior can go along a continuum. But what we've seen repeatedly with people who have presented for treatment is that these are people who've gone beyond the concept of just being horny, and there are other levels of destruction and consequences that have come about due to their being horny, so to speak. So it's those consequences that seem to drive people to seeking help. And some of the consequences sometimes are being caught, like Governor Spitzer, losing a job because of this, family members being hurt by the behavior.
But even the American Psychiatric Association, I don't know where the American Psychological Association stands on this. I probably just embarrassed myself just now. But it's not in the diagnostic manual. There's lots of addictions in our diagnostic manual, but there's no sexual addiction.
It's interesting because you talked about meeting Carnes probably in the early, mid-80s, and our last DSM manual was, I believe, in, 94, 93? Mm. And so what's happened since the 80s to the present is that there is a lot more consensus that this is a problem. The next manual isn't due out, I believe, the latest I heard, 2010, and there is a lot of discrepancy among people that treat this as to what to call it. And until we can agree as to what to call it, is it addiction, is it compulsive disorder?
Well, let's talk about the phenomenon itself. Mm-hmm. Controversy aside, what is addiction, and how do we make the distinction between that and horniness? I mean, you know, study about male fantasies, you know, men are mostly thinking about sex or money.
Right. Well, the idea of addiction, so if we just talk about addiction in general, but then we break apart sexual addiction, we're looking at sexual addiction as the arousal is to a mood-altering experience versus when you're talking about drugs. The arousal is to the substance. So right away, drugs are things you tend to ingest, whereas sexual experiences are things that you can also recreate constantly in the brain, therefore the idea of fantasy and being able to repeat these things over and over. So what tends to happen is that a lot of this can happen internally and extremely secretively, so that people may engage in this behavior very much alone. They don't know. Nobody else tends to know about the behavior. I had somebody mention to me last week, well, you know, Spitzer makes so much money. Why didn't he just hire somebody to do, you know, set up these appointments with prostitutes? And I looked at this person because I thought, well, the whole issue here is when people are doing this behavior, they're trying to hide it. And they're usually pretty embarrassed and what we also call ashamed of what they're doing, yet they can't seem to stop. So when we talk about addiction in general, you tend to need more and more over time, creating more possibility for more consequences because your thinking starts to become more distorted as your need for the behavior tends to increase.
So this brings us to the question of the brain and brain chemicals, because any addiction, when you are craving that kind of euphoria, really does impair judgment. Mm-hmm. So what's happening in the brain?
Well, there's a lot we still don't know about the brain. And to get back again to the DSM idea, what we don't have a lot of good research studies out there to look at what is sex addiction, how to define it, how to diagnose it, with backing up of with brain studies. What we're learning a lot from studies that have to do with trauma and other types of addiction, like chemicals and alcohol, is that there are certain areas that seem to be more affected than others, things around judgment. And then there are things around sort of the arousal states in us that are normal, the things we do that, you know, that get elevated around relationships or around sex or around food. But for addicts, they seem to be more on overdrive in those areas. So those parts of the brain tend to be either overdeveloped or underdeveloped, creating these deficiencies that they're constantly compensating for.
So is this about brain? anatomy? Is it about genetics or is it about something else?
Well, to me, it's about all of our brains are impacted by early years of development. So if you look at, you know, a normal brain, that meaning a child that grows up in an environment that's nurturing and very much for the child, so to speak, and the child grows up feeling safe and connected to their world around them, then you have a child that learns to regulate better their urges and their desires. If you have a child that is raised in environments that are less than optimal for a child, that are either negating or abusive,
Give us some examples.
So some examples might be an alcoholic family, for example, or an environment where a child is physically or sexually abused, or environments where the parents do not seem to spend a lot of time with a child and emotionally hurt the child as a result of their neglect.
Well, there's a lot of children, especially these days, that are neglected who don't grow up to be addicts, or especially sex addicts.
They may not necessarily become addicts, but sometimes, depending on how they're raised in those environments, they may be more susceptible to being in a relationship with an addict, meaning that they learn that their needs are not valued enough, so they learn to externalize their sense of self onto what other people need of them. An addict learns to externalize their sense of self in terms of how they feel when they engage in behavior like sex or drugs or alcohol. But other people in those same families might externalize their sense of self in terms of how you're going to make me feel better.
Looking back, I mean, you've treated many sex addicts over the years. Do you see a history almost universally of injury, abuse, neglect? Is there always some kind of history in their families that would contribute?
Yes, but one of the abuses that I find most prevalent, because people can tend to report some histories in their family, whether they were abused or if a parent died or if a parent was an addict, they might be able to report those things early on. But usually it's over time in treatment. And you, as the therapist, recognize some of those other deficits, things like not getting good direction, not learning basic life skills on how to manage, you know, self-care or relationships to others, not learning how to ask for what you need. These more, what I would call more covert or more emotional neglect kinds of things are extremely pronounced. And the one study that Patrick Carnes did that seems to be, to date, the only sort of extensive study that was done to look at addicts, which was done for, they were in treatment over 7 years, what they found was 97% of those people self-identifying as an addict found they came from emotionally neglectful households.
Well, on the other hand, if we look the other way, that all of those coming from households that didn't give the support, the structure, the care that a psyche needed, probably a very small percentage of them would grow up to be sexual addicts.
I'm sorry, how do you mean that?
Well, I'm saying that not everybody who was neglected as a child, small percentage is going to become
a sexual addict. That's exactly right.
Some might become depressed, some might not have an impact, some could wind up being CEOs of industry because they were self-starters.
Right. Well, actually, there's a lot of sex addicts that are very productive and high-functioning CEOs, et cetera, that can be externally very functional and high-achieving, but it's these emotional areas that often get, what I like to say, sort of split off or cut off from who they are.
So as soon as that came out of my mouth, when I said CEOs, I'm thinking, you know, Spitzer and
governors,
Clinton.
Governors, right.
So, never mind. Scratch that. We're going to, you know, there's no delete keys on the radio, you know? It's frustrating. We're going to have to take a short break and get back. We're talking about sexual addiction today with psychotherapist Kara Tripodi. She's director of STAR, Sexual Addiction and Recovery. It's here in Wynwood, Pennsylvania. What's the number there, by the way?
610-658-2737 or info@starhealing.org, and the website is starhealing.org.
She's also the co-author of Mending a Shattered Heart, a guide for partners of sex addicts. Our number is 888-477-9499. I want to talk when we get back, Cara, about what happens with couples. And I also, we're going to talk when we do get back, we're going to talk with John, who is in recovery and agreed to join us and share his story. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
As the Philadelphia City Council talks about how to spend the $4 billion in taxes paid by everyone who lives, works, or plays in the city, we want you to have your say. WHYY, in partnership with the Daily News, presents It's Our Money, reports on the city budget not only in a way that you can understand, but also in a way in which you can participate. To give your testimony about the city's priorities for the coming year, visit our website at whyy.org and click on It's Our Money.
You're embarrassed.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. You interrupted a delightful discussion I was having with psychotherapist Cara Tripodi. She's director of STAR, Sexual Addiction and Recovery. It's here in Wynwood. She's the co-author of Mending a Shattered Heart, a guide for partners of sex addicts. As promised, we're going to go to the phones. We've got a lot of callers. But I want to start with John, who's graciously agreed to join us on the phone. He describes himself as a sex addict in recovery. John, do we have you on the air?
Yeah.
John, thanks for joining us. Was that a fair description?
I would say sex and love addict for me.
Why?
My love addiction is an addiction that I seek other people's approval, especially women, and I want to be in relationships with women because women verify me. I'm also codependent.
Well, everybody wants approval. I'll talk about me, John. I mean, I want approval, and
but I go above and beyond. I sacrifice my own wants and desires for someone else's. To make them happy so I feel better about myself.
When did you realize you were out of control, or did you?
Over the course of time, I would say probably in my 20s, I thought I could stop what I was doing, and I would stop for maybe a week or two, but then I picked up the addiction like a drug and just went back to it.
When did you begin to realize that you needed help?
I didn't begin to realize I needed help until December of 06 when my wife caught me online looking at online pornography.
And was that the behavior primarily that you were engaging in?
Yes.
Online pornography?
Yes, at that time.
Yeah, that's a whole other issue. You mean at that time there was other behaviors you had engaged in over the years?
Yes, behaviors for paying women for sex, degrading women on the phone sex line and chat rooms, lying and stealing, and manipulation for friendship or other purposes.
When did it all start and how?
When I was about 14 years old, actually 12 and 13, a friend of mine gave me a pornographic magazine, and shortly afterwards I started calling phone sex lines, and shortly after that I went to adult bookstores, and shortly after that I started paying women for sex.
Right at puberty?
I was 16 when I went to my first adult bookstore, even though the sign says 18, I got in. And I was 18 years old when I first paid a woman for sex.
So let's go back. I don't know if you heard Cara and I chatting before we went to break about some of the family dynamics.
Yes, I did.
So do you have a history that you feel contributed?
Yes, both of my parents were workaholics, especially my father. He worked 7 days a week, came home, ate, slept, and just repeated the process. That was his program. My mother was a homemaker and raised me and controlled me to nth degree, where She would take me everywhere she went when I was a child. She was afraid to leave me alone. She was just a controlling mother, and she also there was emotional abuse and sexual abuse too.
In your childhood?
Yes.
At what age?
My mother started. I was at age of five.
John, you know, you described your background, and then you said, "Oh, and there was also sexual abuse." Kind of, and oh yeah, there was that, as though that was relatively minimal compared to your father's absence and your mother's anxiety.
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that, because I think my father not being there for me led me to down this road or partial piece of him, because I just wanted his love, and I knew I had my mother's love. And just the past year, I just discovered back in 07 that my mother sexually abused me. It was a set of memories that were suppressed for a long period of time. And she just passed away in August of last year. And a lot of those memories came up around that time.
You are in recovery now. What does that mean?
Recovery to me means taking each day one day at a time, doing self-care. Going to 12-step meetings for this addiction.
What does self-care mean?
Self-care means eating three meals a day, getting up and not sleeping 12 hours a day, paying the bills on time. Simple, mundane tasks that everybody does, but for some reason for me, I let them go, or I don't take care of myself. Reading, meditation, walking, exercising.
I see. Let me turn to you, Kara. Is this story unusual, the inability to care for oneself when you get lost in an addiction, to pay your bills, even to eat meals?
Yes. First, I just want to thank you, John, for calling in. I know that this is not easy for a lot of people to even speak out about this as somebody in recovery. So I just really want to commend you for the courage it takes to do what you're doing. But yes, Dr. Gottlieb, this is pretty typical in the sense that well, sometimes people didn't really learn some of these skills. Again, they didn't learn how to manage life, and so sometimes addictive behaviors is a way to sort of say, oh, I can, you know, I'm bored, I don't want to have to worry about these responsibilities, so let me just go and act out. But as behavior progresses, people tend to get sort of sloppy in managing their overall life because they're taking more and more time to either engage in behavior, prepare to act out in the behavior, or recover from the behavior. So there's a lot of energy spent in this behavior, even though the actual act may not take that much time.
John, was sex for you a source of pleasure, or was it kind of respite from your demons?
It was both. When it was by myself, it was a respite for my worries, for my stress, for my anger, emotions that I was not handling in a proper way. The love piece would come in when I would be sexual with a woman, that mm-hmm. I felt whole, I felt mm-hmm. worthy, I didn't feel shamed or guilt. Unfortunately, after the act itself and all my acting out, I did feel that guilt and shame afterwards, on the money that I spent, on the time that I spent, missed appointments, just feeling the guilt build up with the shame.
How are you doing now?
I'm doing much better. I just got out of inpatient about a month ago, and that really kicked me in the pants, so to speak, in my recovery. I recommend inpatient to any sexual addict out there, sex and love addict or sex addict. It's the best gift you can give to yourself.
How are you feeling about yourself these days?
Much better, much better. Excuse me. For most of my life, for example, I grew up without boundaries. My mother did not have any boundaries. I didn't have any boundaries. And I treated everybody else in the world with no boundaries. And now what I can do is I can set up boundaries for myself to protect myself and also to give myself self-worth, including honesty and integrity.
I've got two questions, and they're both related. I want to know if you're still with your wife, and if you are still having sex, and what that's like for you.
I am not still with my wife. About a year after the addiction, she stayed with me, in support, and she still supports me today. Hmm. Unfortunately, towards the end of that 1 year, towards the end of last year, I created a lie that's part of my addiction, and she found out about it. I told her eventually, but at that point, she said, basically, I can't. You're not where I need you to be in this relationship.
Are you still having sex?
No. We are separated, and we have filed for divorce. We're actually in the process of getting divorced. We both recognize, I think, we're both unhealthy because she is a co-addict.
Right.
That we both need to get healthy in our respect to each other.
We're gonna talk about co-addiction later. Have you been celibate?
Yes, I have.
I would imagine that makes it easier.
Yeah, I have. My last acting out was July 9th of 2007, so I've been clean now for over 8 months.
Can I ask you how you feel right now doing this, chatting with me on the radio?
I feel great. I feel open. There's a part of me that I think the world should know about sex addiction, so by me doing this, I think I fulfill that idea. But also, I'm open about my addiction because all my life I've been secretive.
Is there a cure? Do you think you'll be in treatment the rest of your life?
I think I will be in recovery for the rest of my life, and I think at some point I'll minimize my recovery pieces, but that's not until down the road for years to come.
Any kids, John?
No children, no.
Okay, that's a whole other topic I'm going to bring up with Kara. John, anything else before we thank you and say goodbye? Anything else you think it's important you want to say about your life, about the issue?
Basically, I just want to give hope to all the sex addicts out there that there is hope. There is hope. Talk to people, make phone calls, go to meetings, and just take it as one day at a time.
John, I want to thank you so much, and I agree with Kara. I think what you did was courageous, and it was a service. I think that's one of the 12 steps, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Dr. Gottlieb.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, Kara, was John's story a common story we hear?
Yes, especially that sometimes even once people, I think he said something about coming into realization of this, or that there was some sort of a bottom that he reached in the end of 06, and that sometimes people will get worse before they get better, even though they've sought out treatment. And it sounds like there were some additional consequences that he had to confront.
Let's go to the phones and get some other perspectives. The lines are lit up. We've got Lynn on line two. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dan.
Hi.
I'm so happy that you have this, that you're putting this topic out there. Hi, Kara. It's Lynn.
Oh, hi, Lynn.
I'm just so pleased that you're educating people. I think that is really the biggest. That is really the biggest issue right now, that people don't have an awareness, and I think, you know, I felt very triggered by all the events with Governor Spitzer, and I think that what happened and the public response and all of that to his behavior and his press conference and all of that, I just feel that it shows that people don't know. They don't know that much about sex addiction. They don't see it as an addiction. I have just really felt that education is lacking right now.
Can I ask you a question about something you said a couple minutes ago?
Yes.
You said the Spitzer thing was a trigger for you. So.
Yes.
Who, tell us about your triggers and what that means to you.
Well, what that meant to me is that it took me back to the discovery of sex addiction in my own marriage. And it just reminded, I mean, it took me back to the pain. You know, I just...
Are you married to a sex addict?
I am married to a sex addict. I am in recovery. I don't know if you call what he's doing recovery, but he does see a therapist right now. You know,
and you decided to stay.
Well, we're separated at the time, at this time, but we do have a relationship. At this point, a divorce is not a given. I do want to see him get better. I do see him as a sick individual.
And what about you? What do you need?
What do I need?
For you. I mean, is there a sense that you need to get better, or are you okay, or?
Oh, no, absolutely. I definitely am very pleased to be in treatment. Going into it, of course, you know, I would have said my family was normal and healthy and all the rest of it. But then, you know, when you start to look at things and you start to realize and you start to feel your feelings and you start to look at the situation and the circumstances, you start to realize that, no, these things are not normal. These are not healthy behaviors.
How did you find out?
Well, it took actually quite a long time. It was my partner who directed me to STAR.
How did that happen?
He went to a 12-step meeting. And someone there told him it would be a good idea, and then he went, and then he suggested that I do the same. And it was eye-opening for me, but it was also a relief to know that there were other people out there who were suffering as I was.
Were you shocked, or was this something you kind of knew and didn't want to know?
Was I shocked about his behavior, or was I shocked about the fact that there are other people who are...
No, were you shocked about his behavior?
There had been a period of time leading up to the discovery that I knew something was wrong in my efforts to communicate about it.
Like, what were you seeing, feeling?
I really saw a change to somebody that I did not recognize
I married. What was he doing?
First of all, he became very secretive about his time and the way he spent his money. He was not accountable in any fashion to me or the rest of the family, and he wanted it that way. He was also, I saw depression, I would say, at the time. I saw depression, and he would not address that. He would not address issues between us.
So you saw him start to kind of withdraw and slip away. Were you seeing any sexual behavior that you were concerned about?
In regard to our relationship, yes, I would say he was very distant and absent from me emotionally as well as physically.
I see. He was withdrawing at every level.
Yes.
Well, Lynn, I want to thank you. Thank you so much for calling in and telling your story. You there? I think
program. I really appreciate it, and I hope people will listen and know that they're not alone.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye bye.
So I hate to use the word typical, but how does someone find out that their spouse is having a problem?
Well, I think Lynn's call is a good example, because these were not, when you were asking her about the behaviors and she was also describing what she was seeing in him, what I call attitudinally and accountability to time, maybe she wasn't seeing visual things about sexual acts that he was engaging in. And that, to me, is a big piece of this, that these are things that are happening in secret. They're usually happening when people are just stealing, you know, half hour, an hour away from their family, with things like the internet and cell phones. There's all these other ways to sort of keep your behaviors more secretive from the rest of your life, your family, etc. So when somebody comes across, I think she used the word discovery, it sounds to me like she came across what he was doing rather than he came to her saying, I have a problem. And discovery for partners is extremely shocking and traumatic for them, meaning they stumble across data that tells them what their spouse has been up to when they didn't have data supporting that before.
And I can't even imagine, I mean, stumbling across data is one thing, but having it being slapped across the face with it. I mean, we've got the public scenario of Elliot Spitzer's wife, but I'm sure it happens privately too, that all of a sudden you're slapped across the face with this.
That's usually, I mean, aside from the media piece with Spitzer, that is usually what happens. Somebody comes across receipts. They maybe intercept phone calls. They look at the cell phone bills that are hundreds of dollars, and it's not making any sense. They see charges on their credit card that say these very fancy names that, you know, sound like these consulting services, when in fact they're really escort massage parlors.
The impact of this, this is too big a question to cover fully right now, but the impact of this is different than infidelity?
Well, it is, because with infidelity, usually there are things that are more situational to the couple. Maybe the person has hit a midlife crisis. Maybe they've been unhappy and they haven't wanted to face it in the marriage. And so there will be a situation that presents to them that they will act upon. Maybe they had a rapport with a colleague at work, or maybe they were at a conference and they met somebody and it developed into something in response to something that was more unaddressed in the relationship, primary relationship.
And with sex addiction?
No, with sex addiction, it is usually something that pre-existed in the relationship, and it is separate from the person that they are involved with, meaning that usually the person, if they became a sex addict, or they discovered they were a sex addict at, say, age 30, it meant that the person they were with at age 30, they would have been that same way if they were with a different partner.
You know, there's been an assumption floating around here. You know, we talk about Spitzer, and I mentioned Clinton.
Right.
And you know, a couple of the calls have been about men.
Yes.
But, you know, I wonder about these call girls or prostitutes.
Yes.
And are any of them sex addicts? And sex addiction, you know, men and women, who, you know, is it roughly equal? Is there a difference psychologically?
Well, I think the different piece psychologically is that, you know, women orient maybe differently to issues in their lives, that they might be more relationally driven. So they might be compulsively in lots of relationships, but they might sort of coin it as, oh, I just can't find a committed partner who wants to commit. They may look at it, you know, rather than that they seem to have a problem with finding safe and appropriate partners. So I think that women seem to have these issues similarly. It tends to be packaged a little differently. But underneath it, I think it's very similar. There is a compulsive need to be noticed, despite the data that tells you this is not a healthy situation. And so they will continue despite that information. The other piece, I think, too, is that women spend a lot of time maybe thinking that the right person's going to come along romantically. Not that men don't think this, but I think women maybe have some different ways that it expresses itself. But underneath it, it's usually about power. You know, so with women that are engaged in prostitution or escorts, mm-hmm. the power is in, look at the power I have over you. You need me that bad. And look at the power I get by getting this money. So there's a lot around power and money. But it seems to be that a lot of women that I've met that have been in the escort industry have often come from traumatic, abusive backgrounds themselves that sort of set them up to objectify their body in some way to engage in this behavior.
We've got to take a break. When we come back, we've got some calls, and I want to talk about treatment. I mean, we have floated out the concept of 12-step programs. I know they've got a long track record,
yes,
but they don't work for everybody.
Oh,
and
no.
I know there's other treatments around.
Right.
You're trained in EMDR. So
right.
I want to hear more about what's out there for treatment for individuals and for couples.
Mm-hmm.
My guest today is a psychotherapist, Kara Tripodi, and we're talking about sex addiction. She's the director of STAR, Sexual Addiction and Recovery. It's in Wynwood. And she's the co-author of Mending a Shattered Heart, A Guide for Partners of Sex Addicts. Like I said, we'll be back in just 60 seconds, and we're going to talk about treatment and what options are out there. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with Michael Kirk, who produced the new Frontline documentary, Bush's War. It's a two-part special about the war in Iraq. Also, the opt-out generation. Meg Wolitzer's new book is about a group of women who choose full-time motherhood over promising careers. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day.
Patty cake?
Patty cake.
Katrina
Patty
Brown's cake. Son wasn't acting like other two-year-olds.
But no one was able to tell her exactly why.
I didn't even know there were doctors that did that.
Finally, she found someone who could.
There's no doubt in my mind that he's on the autistic spectrum.
There are things that we can do to help. I can handle that so much better.
Identifying autism.
He's seeing our child, how he really is.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about sexual addiction, what it is, what causes it, what to do about it, and what treatment options there are. We're with Carol Tripodi, who's director of STAR, Sexual Trauma and Recovery in Wynwood, Pennsylvania. So let's go right to the questions. When someone comes to you, what are the options? First of all, how do they get to you? Do they get to you voluntarily, or are they sent from either a threatening spouse or a parole officer? Or
A little bit of all sorts of ways, meaning that either a colleague in the community knows about us and sort of recognizes that that what she or he is treating is becoming very clear that it's addiction, sex addiction, so they'll refer to our program for that reason. A lot of times people have gotten caught, and therefore they are being told, they're given an ultimatum, you get into a program, or we're separating. And then there are people that seek out treatment because of their own crisis internally.
Do any of those affect a prognosis?
Do any of those affect?
Well, if you come in on your own and say, I want to help, versus somebody who comes in and said, my wife's going to leave me if I don't, does that affect prognosis or no?
You know, this gets to something a little bit different in that I think a lot of the addictions, but I'll speak specifically on sexual addiction, sex and love addiction, a lot of this has to do with tremendous amounts of isolation and shame. And when an addict gets confronted and they are, sort of tell all to their partner about what they've been doing, what you learn is that they feel tremendous amount of relief that this very secretive side of them is out, and they have a place now that they can begin to talk about it. But as it relates to will they get better, is that an indicator of getting better? Yes, sometimes it is, because they have a partner that cares and is invested, but it's not always the case. Some people need to have more consequences before they're able to stop the self-destruction.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Matt on the line. Matt, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you both so much for talking about this. I think I've basically known that there's been a problem most of my life, and there's so many people that just don't get it. Therapists that don't get it, or people out in the community, spouses, and so I really appreciate that. I have a long history of sex addiction. I've been looking at Playboys in first grade compulsively, I pretty much have done everything that you all have mentioned so far. And I guess my question is, what's the long-term prognosis for someone that's had so many problems with it? Sex for me is just, it's so dark and empty. Is it always going to be so dark?
Let me ask you a question before we turn to Kara. You sound young. May I ask how old you are?
I'm in my 30s.
And how long are you in treatment?
Yes. I've been, I go to sexual addiction meetings 7 days a week, and I've been doing that since 2003. And I've been in treatment since 2005.
And sex still feels dark and frightening to you?
Yeah, it's like a nightmare.
Yeah.
I guess that's my question. Is it always going to be a nightmare?
Can you describe the nightmare? Not sex, but what happens to you emotionally, what you mean by a nightmare?
Well, I feel the compulsion all the time. But, when I'm with someone or, you know, looking at pornography, it just feels so incredibly empty.
Okay.
I
don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Let me hang on, okay? We're gonna put you on hold, and I want to talk to Kara about this. Mm-hmm. The fact that it feels empty might support his not acting out. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it might be that that's changed. That maybe he didn't always feel empty.
Right.
That sometimes people engage in the behavior to, you know, for pleasure, but also to lessen pain. But sometimes they do it because they're afraid to not do it, meaning the withdrawal of it is as scary as the, you know, seeking it for pleasure.
Kara, when he said he still feels compulsive all the time, mm-hmm. you sighed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, what was your reaction? This man has been in treatment for years, and he still suffers every day. Mm-hmm. And the question I hear is this my life now? Am I going to suffer every day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the sigh was that just I could hear the pain in that, and just appreciating that this is such an uphill battle, that for some people this is so severe of a problem that the attachment to it is so unbelievably difficult to imagine not having in their life, at least the way it's been manifested.
Well, let me press you, Matt. Hang in there with us, because I'm going to be your advocate here. Let me press you on Matt's sake. Mm-hmm. He's been in treatment mm-hmm. for years. Mm-hmm. Is it always going to be this way?
Mm-hmm. No, it's not always going to be this way. And my thought would be what does his treatment entail? And sometimes that the treatment means we have to help people go a little deeper around what is this attachment still about, that the emptiness is so awful and yet they're still very drawn to it.
All right, let me argue with you again on Matt's. So that model says there's something the patient, Matt, needs to understand more, work harder on.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, we're talking the beginning of the show now, maybe I'm about to express my own frustration with this field. We're talking the beginning of the show about brain chemistry
mm-hmm.
and brain anatomy. And here's a guy that still feels compulsive mm-hmm. every day. And I wonder about OCD. I mean, sexual compulsion is compulsion. We've got a pretty good track record
right.
with obsessive compulsive right. disorder. We know how to treat that.
That's right. Well, I guess my point would be the focus would center on what is keeping this so strong, and then you branch from sort of a holistic perspective, which includes, you know, where is somebody like Matt at around medication? Are they on any? Are they not? You know, looking at some of the structural things that would help in the day-to-day management of urges, et cetera, and then some of what I call that deeper work, which is maybe there's an attachment here that's keeping him sort of wedded to feeling so negative about the self, and that's what I meant.
Matt, did you get your question answered?
Yeah. I know a lot of people that, you know, have found long-term sobriety and, you know, are in wonderful relationships. And so I know that that's a possibility. I don't know, for me, it feels so difficult. You know, I am on medication. Mm-hmm. I am in group therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about to go bankrupt, so I can't afford the individual therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I do my meetings 7 days a week. And it's just, it's frustrating for me because I see so many people that, you know, are able to get their lives together, and I just feel like it's not happening for me for some reason.
You sound like you're also managing a lot of losses at the same time as you're trying to achieve what you see other people in recovery have. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah. I've lost everything.
Yeah. So
I lost my family, my house, my career.
Yeah. So maybe there's this fusing of staying towards the addiction because it helps you not to grieve.
And, yeah, I was just going to say that there's a lot of things going on with Matt. Matt, we're going to have to say goodbye and thank you for your call and your openness. But there is a grief process underneath that here.
That's right. That's right.
We all need to do. You know, mm-hmm. So somebody once, a colleague of mine once said, buried feelings are buried alive. The question, final question, and unfortunately we don't have a ton of time to devote to it, is what about the kids? What happens to the kids mm-hmm. when there's sex addiction?
Well, I think that what happens with the kids is they are definitely affected, for one. How you intervene with children is a very different kind of question, because sexuality is something that's inherent to all of us, and so we want to be very sensitive about children's own sexual development and where children are at in that.
What do they need?
It depends on what the situation is in terms of what is going on. Sometimes what they need is stating the obvious. For example, kids are, depending on the age of the kids as well, but if parents are all of a sudden not sleeping together in the same room, for example, or if parents are now separating, or if one parent is going off for inpatient treatment, you know, they need to know sort of the things that are in that they visually see, and they need the validation of what they've experienced is occurring. So sort of a here and now concrete approach to their needs.
So there is treatment available so that kids are less likely to repeat the cycle.
Yes, yes.
Well, unfortunately, like I said, we are out of time. We really could have used much more. I want to thank you, Kara. Yes,
thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for the work you do. I want to thank all of our callers who called in courageously. Kara Tripodi is a psychotherapist. She's director of STAR, Sexual Trauma and Recovery. It's in Wynwood. She's also co-authored Mending a Shattered Heart, a guide for partners of sex addicts. What's the phone number and the web address?
The phone number is 610-658-2737, and the web address is starhealing.org, and you can also find information about 12-step meetings regarding this problem on our website or when you call us.
Thanks so much. Well, join me this coming Wednesday, the 26th, at the Center City Barnes & Noble. I'll be talking about my new book, Learning from the Heart. For more information, check out my webpage at drdangottlieb.com and contact us here at Voices. That's voices at whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Gita Simons helped us with today's production. Our intern is Amanda Reyes. Our associate producer is Elisa Walters. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.